Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as promised, we have another patriotic leader, radio show host, author, book coming out. As a matter of fact, last time we talked, I think we posted your trailer on our website, and so hopefully everything is going well in the production of the book. And this is Angeline, by the way, folks. Sometimes I get ahead of myself, but this is Angeline, and welcome back, Angeline. We really enjoyed your contribution last time. So how's the book going?
It seems to be going pretty good. I have a couple little publisher issues, okay. But right now I do have the electronic Kindle is up there. The audio book is still in production.
Okay.
And I'm trying to iron out a couple print issues, and the print will be available. But everything's going well. The actual launch date is November 28, okay. But you can still see them for pre-order on Amazon.com.
Okay. So is the electronic book only in Kindle, or do you have a Mobi file where you can get it from Apple and all the rest of the
As far as I know right now, it's Amazon, okay. Barnes & Noble, and Books A Million.
Okay. All right. Well, Barnes & Noble's a large footprint as well, but I think nobody's bigger than Amazon when it comes to content. I mean, their model was to become the king of content in the 90s, and when they got there, they started going elsewhere. But anywho, great. So, folks, the electronic book is out, and the book title again?
It's Soulless Society, The Ultimate Deception That Took the Land of Plenty to a Nation of Death.
There you go. So with that, I promised the audience that we would have a conversation regarding Republic Review. Now, I've brought my audience along because this is my annual, I'll just say, curriculum. We cover the ratification debates, and we usually cover other content. I like to kick the year off with the Tory Acts because in January 2nd was the first Tory Act, and there was a series of Tory Acts that actually occurred before the Revolution and actually before the Declaration of Independence. And so I kind of start this whole evolutionary process of this experiment that we call our constitutional republic and helping everybody understand what was going on. Why were these Tory acts really important? Because most people think that, you know, property rights are sacred. Well, they're only sacred for U.S. citizens. Those folks who were, you know, actual colonists, who were our neighbors and family members, who actually decided to support the British, lost everything. So, I mean, these types of things that I cover throughout my annual process, it's all, I try to do it really close to, you know, that day we talk about it. If it happens, like sometimes January 2nd is on the weekend. So how can I do that? But anywho, I digress. I've asked you to kind of immerse yourself. And I know you're really busy with personal life and just life happens to, you know, try to immerse yourself in this stuff academically. But you've, I think, gone through the Republic Review process and have prepared some questions and so forth. So I'm going to kind of turn the helm over to you and let you drive the questions as an interview of me, if that's appropriate. So go ahead.
Okay. So what I like about Republic Review is it's finally an answer to the question that we've all been asking. What can we do? We are so barraged with all of the garbage happening in politics and the government. And we see all this bad news every day, all day long. And so I think the average American that cares doesn't know. They throw their hands up. Well, what can I do? It is so far gone that I don't think there's anything to do. And then you taught me about this Republic Review. And I'm still learning. You know, I looked through all the documentation you sent me But at least it's a solution instead of just let's get on the mic and, you know, complain about the terrible politicians and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
So you had mentioned, because I've been listening to you and Paul, and you had mentioned a Trevor Loudon article, and I think I found a link on your website. Mm-hmm. It was in Epoch Times.
Yep.
And he basically lists maybe a half a dozen or more solutions, and one of them was Republic Review. And just to sum up for your audience, I'm sure knows it, you know, from top to bottom, but my audience, I don't think the majority have heard of it. So I'm just going to give a short definition. I believe this is from Trevor Loudon. Basically, it's just, first of all, the Constitution is a contract, and it's an audit of that contract, the contractual obligations on the part of the general government, meaning the federal government, and the states would exercise their authority to validate and make sure that this general government is in compliance with the contract or the Constitution.
Yes.
Would that pretty much be it in a nutshell?
Yeah, and actually it is kind of that simple, but there's actually, believe it or not, there's, you know, how do we get there? There's all of those types of questions, which I'm expecting, or my anticipation is, you know, those are the questions you're going to have for me. But yeah, it is that simple. As Madison actually referred to it in his report and later on in some of his other documentation, and actually in a letter to John G. Jackson in 1821, because at that point in time, in 1821, the United States government had really started going sideways. This was just after this Missouri Compromise, which enforced, or actually compelled, states. In other words, if you became a state in this union and you were south of this very particular latitude on the earth, on this planet, then you had to be a slave state. Taking away the self-destiny and the sovereignty of a state coming forward to becoming a state in the union. And so people just scratch their heads and go, where did they get that authority? Then some of these other rulings that were actually occurring and happening were just absolutely alarming to John G. Jackson and several other people. And because John G. Jackson had I'll just say a link family-wise to Dolly Madison. They sent an email, or not an email, they sent a letter to James Madison requesting that he release his notes on the Constitutional Convention because they felt his notes would give them the insights to what the Constitution really meant. And and Madison's response was very clean, succinct, and forthright. And in it, he basically said it didn't matter. It didn't matter what I thought or anybody at the Constitutional Convention thought the Constitution to mean. The only thing that matters, he says, I had this obligation, we all have this obligation to recognize and follow the understanding that the states had at the time of ratification. In other words, how the Constitution was explained to the states, what it meant, how it was defined, that's the only thing that really matters. And what he basically just articulated is the essence of contract law. When you walk away in making a contract, when the two parties, you know, sever from in this contract negotiations and they execute the contract, the only thing that matters is what they understood. That's always usually where the problems come up anyway, because did they really stipulate that? And so what I do is I like to give people, and I did I tell you about selling the car to you? Have I gone down that path with you? If you're going to buy a car from me?
Yes, yes.
And I told you that you could get a free car wash.
Right.
In basic contract law, how I've stipulated that contract to say you can have this if you buy this car from me today. Well, you bought the car from me today. You are now legally entitled to a car wash every week. However, they stipulated, and they didn't give away anything. As a matter of fact, when you go through the ratification debates, the Federalists were very consistent throughout the states of how they, I'll say, confined or denned the federal government to only the enumerated powers. As a matter of fact, Madison, in his report on the Virginia Resolutions of 1800, in that report, he basically said that it was the Constitution during the ratification debates was constantly justified that it was limited to those enumerated powers. And that's all they can do. So, you know, why would we think that, you know, what they were doing with the Alien Sedition Acts, acting outside of that, why would they think that they could actually pass laws like that? And in kind of helping people understand, what is this report? The report on the Virginia resolutions was a response to the states, because what happened was the Kentucky resolutions went out to all of the states and the Virginia resolutions went out to all the states. And basically, they were in sync. The Virginia resolutions adhered to and said, yes, absolutely, we all need to do this, and we all need to take the necessary measures enforcing the federal government into compliance. And all of the other states came back and made insinuations. We consider you being treasonous. Are you? Where do you get off making these assumptions? Only the judiciary. This is why we go through these documents, to help explain why the judiciary can't be trusted with these types of things. If it's not right. delegated to them, they don't have the authority.
Right. So basically what you're saying is there are enumerated or listed powers given to this general / federal government.
Yes.
And they have more than overstepped.
Correct.
Now, I want to reel it back to Loudon.
Okay.
So what I like about this is he gives an example. Now, this is good for teaching, so people get it. So most of the states, he said, get about a 10% of their education budget from the feds, making them almost completely subservient to the Department of Education. This is one example.
Yep.
I could think of a million examples. I have been saying for years that the states need to quit taking federal money. The local governments need to quit taking state money, because once you do that, you are giving up your power, and now you become a slave to whomever you take the money.
Yep.
So I like that he mentions this, and the first thing that came to my mind, I don't know about where you live, but I live in a place that's heavy tourism, and I can see all the money that our local governments must be taking from the state, and then they probably get it from the feds for these 15-minute sustainable cities. So here we go again. The reason why my local government is doing things that the people don't like is because they are beholden to the state, and then probably ultimately this comes down from the feds, and who knows, I don't know if the UN is sprinkling some money to the feds. I don't know how far up it's going. But so to me, the states are not without blame here. They are taking the payments, and that is what is making, I think they are willingly in a lot of ways giving up their power when they take that money. So why did I bring all this up? Let's go to, here's my second question. So thinking about everything I just said about taking these payouts, how could possibly this Republic Review work if you do not have a moral and aware population, people, and thus you don't have a moral group of government representatives or politicians or elected officials or whatever you want to call them? I call them crooks. But if we don't have morality as our foundation amongst all these groups that I just named, how could we possibly make Republic Review work? Because if everybody is a crook from the get-go, then how do you rein that in to make this remedy work? That's my question.
So philosophically, when I look at communists, one would think that the communists are actually void of morality because they believe in compulsion and everything else. That, you know, that the state has full control. They dictate everything. But I've yet to see a communist that doesn't have a lock on the door of their home, and they don't have a lock on their car, and that they actually really believe that everything is for free and sharing this communal lifestyle. Even in the communes, even in socialism, there is the distrust of other people. And so when we talk about morality, it always starts with the most fundamental. I mean, because when we look at the objects of government, the two primary objects of government is one to protect life and the other is to protect private property. And so the civil law that was created under the Roman Empire, they were supposedly the first that actually articulated this concept of several property right. In other words, if it's your property, then you only you have the right to it. But actually, this goes all the way back to the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. And so fundamentally, most everybody has what I would say is this base moral that, you know, taking from somebody is wrong. That we have a lot of people today that have become so, I'll just say, animalistic, where they've lost what you're talking about. But I don't think America has crossed that line. I think most of the people in America still recognize that they're doing something wrong. Like these people in San Francisco or these other cities that are getting away with stealing up to 1,000 because they know that if they go beyond 1,000, then they actually are in trouble. So they contain their theft to something that's allowable because they're just gaming the system. But when they take that stuff home, they put it into their home and they lock their house up because they don't want anybody else to have it. So there is this level of morals, I'll say morals within our society, but I understand exactly what you're saying. One of the most important things, and this is why I really try to appeal to the religious right, because one of the things that is constraining the religious right is this concept of legislating religion. Now, it started in 1920 with the Scopes trial, where the federal courts basically said, thou shalt not teach creation in our schools. And they removed the Bibles, they removed prayer. They used this concept of the separation of church and state to create a godless society, and they used the law to do it and outright violated our rights. So when we come down to where we can actually get people to start agreeing, when we look at the issues, not on the moral or the societal moral, like abortion being wrong, and we look at it in the legal aspect of the contract, they don't have the authority, then it's hard for anybody to actually argue against that. When you go into court and we say killing babies is morally corrupt and wrong, we should not be doing this, it becomes an issue of morals. Well, my morals don't say that. But when it comes down to you have no authority to be involved in this, then it changes the argument to whether you legitimately talk or even be involved in abortion. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think what you just said is an important point. Getting back to that contract, there's very few powers that they have. But the thing is, we are so far removed from the original contract, I guess. It's there, but nobody's adhering to it. So then what good is it? So I guess out of that comes a couple of things. First of all, I don't think the average person has ever heard about Republic Review. I had never heard.
Right.
Do any of these elected officials know about Republic Review? Is it, and here's my ignorance, was it ever spelled out anywhere, or did this only come up with Jefferson and Madison in those resolutions that you sent me?
Okay.
Was that the beginning of it, or was it something that was in the back pocket that could be used if they ever got out of line or didn't stay in their lane?
Yeah, so if you listen to Paul and I reading the Kentucky resolutions, when Thomas Jefferson really throws down the gauntlet and says, look, the federal government has no authority to do this, and in that resolution, he literally audits the Constitution and identifies how each of these separate acts, all four of these acts, and how they violated this part of the Constitution, that part of the Constitution, and so forth. And then towards the variance, he starts off with this hyperbole that, or it's not even hyperbole, he's actually making these axioms. He's basically saying, hey, look, we the states did not submit to an unlimited government, that we defined your powers to be thusly and not to base, not, you do not have power to your discretion. In other words, you can't choose what you can do. We've only delegated these powers to you. And then in Resolution 8, This is where he gets down to what has to happen. He basically says that the states need to form committees of conference and correspondence. This actually goes back to an older document, and I brought this up with Paul on Federalist Paper 49, where in Federalist Paper 49, they cite Jefferson's book, The Notes on the State of Virginia, a book that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1783. In this book, based on the Virginia Constitution, Thomas Jefferson talks about two separate mechanisms, two conventions. What is a convention? Most people think that a convention can only be a body of delegates that are making governmental decisions or what have you. Actually, in engineering, the convention is a process, and it is the accepted process. In other words, the standards of convention in engineering is this is the process that you follow for you to for you to get the expected outcome. If you don't follow the convention, you won't get that outcome. And so, and the same thing with medicine. The convention is really a standard. And he talks about using two conventions, though, and he's actually talking about two separate processes of holding or getting government to do two separate things. One convention is used for the creation or the altering of a constitution and or the form of our government. The other convention that he referred to, and this is all in caps, we're dealing with the breaches of that compact. And so they didn't get into the details, but clearly when they finally got to Kentucky and the Virginia resolutions, they were basically calling out how the contract was being violated and which why specifically they did not call for the state to petition the federal government for a constitutional convention. And specifically, they did not go into court, into the attorney general, or have the state sue the federal government by going into the court and saying, you have no authority to do this. In other words, there's two paths right there. When the federal government violates their oath of office and they violate the constitution that they're supposed to support, then what do you do? And so this is where, you know, they started acting and they gave us the breadcrumb of what to do. You actually have to get the parties as the parents to that creature that was created, the federal government, because the states are the parents. And in creating that federal government, they have the authority to force that little child to behave in accordance with those powers delegated and say, we never gave you the power to do the rest of these things. So what has happened is we've been caught up in this binary conversation that we either have to form a convention or we don't form a convention. Technically, there are other paths, and I already gave you one of those paths. One path is actually going in, and when we saw Obamacare, we saw 29 states actually stand up against it. 26 actually formed a single lawsuit, and I think the other three went down independent paths. But bottom line, when you have that many states standing up and saying you shouldn't do that, and then walk into a court over a matter that they have no jurisdiction over, then the states are literally surrendering their sovereignty to that court to give them the outcome that they're seeking, and they will never receive it. Because the court, once it has that sovereignty, can now serve itself. And that's exactly what they've been doing for over two centuries, is we've been duped into believing that we have to go to the courts. We don't. And that's why Madison, in his report on the Virginia resolutions at the very end of this document, these are so powerful, he actually identifies why the court cannot be trusted, because they can actually assume powers that's not delegated and grant themselves these powers. And so that's why you cannot go into the court. And by getting these people, every time I look and I see this, the CO2 pipeline, this is a really hot issue right now. And it's actually going to affect every state. If you look at the map of the CO2 pipeline planning, this is all basically placating this unconstitutional treaty that was created to reduce Americans' carbon footprint. And what it's actually going to do is it's going to take away people's property rights, and it's going into every state. If it hasn't happened in Florida, it will, because it happens. If you look at the map, every state is going to be affected by this. It's all starting in Iowa, where most people don't even care about what's happening in the heartland, and that's why they're starting there. and they're going to take their property rights away. They're going to create precedents. And by the time they get to the major states like Florida, California, and the rest of these big populated states, then everybody go, well, what the heck's happening? And they've already created precedents. But anyway, back to this whole compact. Jefferson talked about these committees of conference and correspondence where we need to get the states in the room. And when Madison replied in his Virginia resolutions, Jefferson really didn't talk about much other than he mentioned nullification. So nullification is a process where the entity, and when we look at the compact, the entity is the parties plural. In other words, to nullify a federal law, one state cannot nullify that. So this is a different path. And there's organizations out there saying, we got to nullify. We got to go down this path of nullification. Madison emphatically, and he even spoke for Jefferson, they both emphatically spoke that if a single state tried to nullify the state laws, they needed to secede, because when you join the union, you've told all the other states that you will share their bondage, you will share their joys and blessings as well as their afflictions. And so that's the whole essence of the union. And so when we have states nullifying this law, nullifying that law, then we create chaos, because, you know, where's the law being followed? And even more so, when a single state stays in the union and they try to nullify the education, they say, we're not going to take that funding anymore, we're nullifying that, then what ends up happening is it doesn't mean that they're still not paying taxes that the federal government is taking from them. You don't solve the problem through nullification. The essence of true nullification is when you get the parties, enough of the parties to say, stop it. You have no authority to do that. That's how it is nullified. A single state nullification doesn't solve the problem, and it only creates chaos. So that's why Jefferson, when you really look at the end, and I gave Paul this over, you know, probably overemphasized analysis, that when you look at the end of the day, Kentucky never nullified that law. It wasn't about nullification. It was about pulling the states together to force the federal government by using all measures necessary to make them comply to their compact. And so how do we do that? So the easy way to explain how we do that, because that should be the logical question, is by using the Constitution. Because one of the beautiful things that even the anti-federalists loved, the oath of office. This was the first and only nation in the world that has a legally binding oath that obligates every public servant to support that Constitution. And so they're now legally bound to do that, and we can call them out for that. Until we got the Bill of Rights, we couldn't call them out. That mechanism wasn't in the Constitution. But now that we have the right to petition government for the redress of grievances, we have the right to call them out. We actually can besmirch them and say, you're a scoundrel. You have no business being a public servant. But unfortunately, there was no teeth to that. And so last time we talked about, and I told you what a godsend the 14th Amendment was. The 14th Amendment actually gives us the teeth, because any senator, any representative, any judge that fails to support the Constitution as defined by the states, because I'm going back to how they actually defined it, when the courts actually redefine, and this is another rat hole, but when the courts start redefining what the Constitution says, that's how they assume powers. And technically, in legal speak, if something was defined in the process of ratification, that becomes the legally binding definition. So in other words, these ratification debates, this is why, and I'll jump ahead into this, because you asked about states, so I want to give you this information. In Wyoming and South Dakota, they introduced bills this past year that went to the floor in Wyoming, and it was killed in committee in South Dakota, that would have established the committee within the state to actually begin the audit of the Constitution. And actually, the first thing that that committee has to do is they have to definitize the Constitution. In other words, they have to go through the ratification debates. And believe me, I'm here to help them. I'll give them all the ratification debates. As a matter of fact, this is a great resource at the University of Wisconsin. But we'll give them the ratification debates, and we'll go through the definitions of how the Federalists actually defined the necessary and proper clause, the exclusive legislation clause, all of these different clauses. And then we can look at how they've actually redefined that to say that's not what it means anymore and go, ah. So anything that's come from the courts that has tried to redefine the Constitution is moot and needs to be done away with. And it's the same thing with the living Constitution, because if you've been to the annotated Constitution on the federal government, it's like almost a 3,000-4,000 page document. This is the federal Constitution, and this is how they interpret it. And they have no business interpreting our Constitution. They're not the parties to it. And so they've completely turned everything inside out and upside down. And so this is what the states, why they have to definitize the Constitution. And then they start doing the audit process. And I guess to cut to the chase, how do we get there? We have to use our First Amendment petitions, and we actually have to hold our public servants accountable. So I probably jumped and probably hit a bunch of questions.
Would they really even give us the time of day on that? And, you know, you mentioned the oath of office.
Yes.
And when I was going through this, I feel like that oath of office is the linchpin that everything stands on. In other words, if we called them out, everybody takes this oath of office, and whether they're ignorant of what they're doing or they're doing it intentionally, you literally could pull the rug from under all of these people in office and clean house that way, just on that one point alone.
Correct. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says if, while under oath, you fail to support the Constitution, then you are no longer eligible. So we, the people, and there are some states that actually created some laws, but they've actually ignored these laws. So we, the people at the county level, need to demand that any person that is in public service, that if they're under oath, we need to implement a process that when somebody has been accused of violating their oath, we need to have a legal process, just like the legal process that we have for sexual harassment or racial discrimination or what have you. I don't know if you're familiar with labor laws, but the federal government has actually created these really beautiful unconstitutional laws that says if a person comes forward in employment and reports to their company, their boss or whomever, that somebody's just sexually harassed them, then that company is now, all of a sudden, the stop clock has started, or a stopwatch has started, and you have a very set amount of time to actually fully investigate, to take the employee in question and put them on leave without pay or leave with pay, whatever, but that person has to be removed, and they have these very specific steps. Why do we not do that to our public servants? Remove them from the state legislature, remove them from the county commission, remove them from Congress immediately when they've been accused of violating their oath, and let it move forward into a common law court to determine whether that person is that's happened, or even make it easier. I mean, if it's really that much of a slam dunk, like the invasion on our southern border, all of Congress should be removed. Not one person in Congress has ever stated that this is an invasion, that the Constitution requires that we place the militia there immediately. Article 4 demands that we place the militia there and that we start repelling this invasion. What everybody's trying to placate and say, oh, no, we just need to stop it. We just want to stop it. And they're okay with the 40, 50 million illegals that are here today, these invaders. They must be repelled because the Constitution demands repelling them, not allowing them to stay. Anyway, I'm sorry. But the point is that we have to start demanding that the law be fully executed. And Section 3 is the law we have to demand to be executed. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. What about... So going back to Republic Review, the flow chart,
yes,
you give a couple of things. Now, the one thing that stuck out to me, it looks like there's a couple ways you can go about this. But what I noticed is must be done by Congress with acknowledgement within resolutions that the general government had failed to follow the amendment process.
Yes.
And then the other one says the process has two paths, Congress or states. Both paths end with ultimate sovereigns, whether those changes are to occur or not.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, so we need congressional agreement with this, or am I reading
that wrong? No, it's not that we need congressional agreement. We need congressional compliance. See, the states have the ability. So what happens if now let's look at Texas, because Texas has some really hardcore blue or I would say progressive communist possible, if you want to go there, or even New York. And they have some really constitutional representatives. Now, when Texas says we demand full compliance, then any person that is in office, they will instantly be called out, because if they actually create a law that says, you know, if you report somebody for violating their oath of office, that person is suspended and then investigated and then removed. If it's been proven, then they are removed and banned for life from ever being a public servant again. And so every single blue, I'll say Democrat in Congress from Texas will all be removed, because they'll be voting in contrary, because even though Congress may say, well, we accept unconstitutional behavior, Texas will say we consider that treason against the Constitution and exercise their right in Article 4 to charge them with treason against the state and actually have them extradited back and replace them. So this is what will end up happening. And it's easy to do within their own state house. So in other words, you'll no longer have rhinos anymore. You will no longer have parties. We'll actually have representatives of the Constitution. We've got to step away from the parties and their agendas, because they're all equally culpable in taking us down the wrong path. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, except that...
How do we do it?
Well, yeah, how do we do it, especially when everybody's got their hand out? And I think that's why the states aren't flexing their muscle in a lot of ways, because people are getting paid off to not call people out and to not do the right thing. And so I feel like this kind of handicaps us with the Republic review process. So
America is at a point where we have to determine whether we're going to maintain our self-governing system or be subjugated to the global governance, going into the digital currency and going into the basically having international entities and losing all of our rights altogether. We're at the cusp. We're at the precipice of being forced into something, because we're going to be told that this unconstitutional debt that we're really not liable for is something that, you know, now we're going to be held accountable when we shouldn't even be held accountable for it. And so they'll basically collapse us because we spent too much and this is what we, you know, we shouldn't have done this, but oh, well, that's okay. The world has this beautiful plan for us to allow us to have the grace of coming into this new governing system. We have a point in time where we have to start making this decision. And the later we allow that decision to occur, if we're going to come back off this precipice, the more bitter the pill is. The further we go, the bitter the pill becomes. And when we get to that brink to where because this is the ultimate point. When we get to the brink, when the federal government says we have to put aside the Constitution, we can't operate this way anymore, we have to actually become a part of this global governing system, period. That we can't, you know, either that or we go into default. This is when the states actually have to stand and say, you have no authority to do that. And oh, by the way, as we look, you had no authority to do all of these things that you did, and that debt we don't owe. You may tell us we owe that, and if that's the case, then we will send you to these nations because they can extract their pound of flesh from you, because you're the one that created this facade of debt. Bottom line, the states at that point can still stand against this mighty wind of the globalist movement, but they need we the people to demand that they do this. And you know what? I don't think that they need 50% or those types of numbers. They just need enough people to support them. And it can start right there in your home. It has to start in your county. We have to take our counties back. And most people don't even realize that all of our states have been unconstitutionally reformed into democracies because of Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, and the redefining of a Republican form of government. most every state's constitution, I don't know about Florida, because you were one of the original early states, I should say, that came into the union. And so you have, I think, either six or seven constitutions, and I'd have to go through your very first constitution, why you set up a bicameral legislative body. This is, I know I'm fire hosing you, but when we look at our bicameral legislative body, we created a new form of republicanism. Republicanism in every other world, it's a representative government of the people, and it is based on the rule of law. In America, we realize that when we, the people, institute a government, we delegate sovereignty to our government. So when we create a county, that county has a level of sovereignty. And for that county in a representative government, it should have representation, which is why the Senate at the state was created, to represent your county government. And then the people were represented from that county in that House of Representatives, just like the federal constitution was designed, where the people of the state are in the House, and then the state legislature are still based on the Article 5 of the Constitution. Every state legislature is guaranteed suffrage in the Senate. And the Senate has completely turned their backs on the states. They don't even listen because they don't vote them in, but they never changed the Constitution in Article 5. And at the very last part of Article 5, it says the states shall never lose their suffrage, or their equal suffrage in the Senate, without their consent. So if they never gave consent to this, then they actually can start pulling back their senators and say, listen, either you will represent us, or, you know, we'll pull you back. We don't care how you got into office. You have an obligation per this Constitution to represent us. That's your state legislature. And so this is a nuance that is completely lost when people learn about republicanism, that we actually have a republic that's formed on representing the sovereigns. We, the people, is the sovereign representation in the houses, and our governments that we form at the local level and the state level are represented in the Senate. So when I look at all the constitutions, they all started, I'll just say, deviating from the federal constitution, because they all started creating amendments based on popular vote. They should have actually based their amendment process based on a percentage of counties. This would protect you from population centers being able to take full control by using population. They knew this is why they put these types of checks and balances at the federal level, and we should have adopted this. But the reason they didn't, and this is the honest truth, the federal constitution never would have been ratified if they started off with every state shall form a government just like this. They would have said, no way. We like what we got. They had to learn first how great that federal constitution was before we could actually start integrating it. And it didn't take long, because after the Constitutional Convention, it only took maybe 5-10 years for every state to at least convene a convention, and they all reformed, because most of the states in the Union were unicameral. They didn't have representation in a Senate and a House of Representatives. So they all changed their form of government to model it kind of like the federal government, because they did say, wow, this is kind of nice. And so when you look at the Enabling Acts, I can show you, like in Wyoming and Washington State and many of the Western states, they actually created their apportionment based on counties, where counties had representation in the Senate, and the people were represented by a certain amount of people in the House of Representatives. Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims basically said representation will be based on people and population apportionment. So they wiped out your county completely. They just said, you no longer have a right to have a county, and your county can't have representation anymore. And that was such an overreach of the Warren Court that I don't think anybody even caught it. So I'm writing an article on this that actually academically dives into this to prove that if we're going to save our states and this republic, we actually have to force our counties to take a stand and actually force our states to, you know, get cleaned up. Our first priority has to be getting a hold of that federal government that is dragging us off this edge.
You know what? Before you go further, what you just said, then then really, though, we need to start at the county level.
Absolutely.
Don't you think, for that to work?
Absolutely.
And then move up to the state and
absolutely.
Up to the feds. Okay.
Absolutely. And so the process of doing that is using First Amendment petitions. And so we've already created a national repository on the Reclaiming the Republic, and I have multiple states that have contributed. And we need every state, and we need everybody's head in the game to start understanding the Constitution. There's actually organizations out there that have subject matter experts. I'll give you a good example. There's an organization called the Constitutional Alliance, and they are subject matter experts on facial recognition technology, biometrics, and all of that, and how that is absolutely this technology that's moving forward out of the Real ID Act that is, they're using facial recognition technology already. Every state has camera systems that are monitoring them. They already know who you are. And so, and social media is kind of helping contribute to all of this. It's out of control, and most people are completely oblivious to this. But bottom line, there's an organization that understands this problem, and they could easily create a First Amendment petition that we could drive into the counties to say, you have to stop this. This is Big Brother right here. You must stop this. You cannot allow this technology to be used. It violates our Fourth Amendment right. We have a right to be secure in our person and our effects. And so as we start, we already have one on medical freedom. We already have one on the Department of Transportation. We already have one on legislative authority, basically one to get us out of the UN. We have 10 that are coming forward. The final one that's coming out of Missouri is property rights, the fact that the federal government has no authority to allow any foreign entity to buy up any of the American resources, whether it be land, companies, nothing. They have no authority delegated to them to allow those that transfer of this nation to be bought up by anybody. It is their job to actually protect our sovereignty. And in other words, it's another egregious violation. But all of these deeds where China owns Smithfield's food, that's all unconstitutional. Where those states where Smithfield is operating, those states should go in and seize those resources and say, China, you can't own this, and actually put it into conservatorship and either sell it or shut it down, whatever. Let the states and let's we the people start getting into this and saying, look, we have to take this country back. And we have to start with our counties. And we got to get county commissioners to understand. And I have two videos that I actually spoke to some county commissioners that I know are friendly to the Constitution. I went over there and talked to these guys. And I kind of start this whole thing off that we have to have a symbiotic relationship with our county commissioners. If they're willing to do their job in supporting the Constitution, we need to help them. If they're not, then we need to replace them. It's that simple. And it's easier to convert them than it is to replace them. But it's not that hard to replace them. And that's the whole point of these petitions, because these petitions become a public relations nightmare. If you hit your county commissioner with a petition, you need to stop this invasion. You need to do this. And they say, hey, it's not my job, not my job. Oh, absolutely. You can endorse these petitions and demand that the state legislature, as our representative, comply to these things. They've just become kind of like the relay point, but they are our local representatives. So this kind of goes down this path. If you're familiar with Martin Luther and his reformation of Christianity, he started the whole process off with petitions. 95 petitions were written that were called theses. Each one of these theses identified how the Catholic Church was doing something that was contrary to the scriptures. They were all basically a petition saying you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. That's what this repository of petitions does as well. And so in creating this repository, I'm now giving every county in this nation a bullet to fire, a metaphorical bullet or a fist to throw at your county commissioners to say, you got to do this, you need to do this, and so forth. And as we build this into hundreds of petitions, because have you seen my color-coded constitution?
Yes.
And so Every line that is color-coded means that there's a petition behind that. And so if you look at how many colors or how many lines and clauses are highlighted. There's, you know, I think at the top of my head were probably 80, 90 petitions. And then there's the petitions to go after every assumption of power that they didn't have, right? You got violations of the Constitution. That's direct violations. And then you have these indirect violations like creating the Department of Transportation. In creating the Department of Transportation, that's a direct violation because they didn't have the authority. It's not enumerated. And same thing with the Housing and Urban Development, Health and Human Services, all of the departments. There's 11 departments that are direct violations. There's executive orders. There's judicial rulings. So we're talking in the magnitudes of hundreds. Mm-hmm. And when people – so this is how Martin Luther changed – because at that point in time, when he put those 95 theses on the door – everybody in the Germanic states were very happy with their salvation. Nobody questioned their salvation. They were going to, you know, go to heaven because they were following the scriptures of what they were being taught. They didn't have the scriptures, but they were following what they were being taught, and they accepted it. As he educated people by printing the Bible and putting it into the hands of the people, we have an ignorant masses where nobody's read the Constitution. And when you go to Hillsdale College, I talk to all sorts of people from Hillsdale College Education or these other places that do the same thing that they do, and none of them get it. None of them understand because they don't teach it as how it's being violated. Like mm-hmm. Martin Luther taught how the scriptures were being violated. That's why the color-coded Constitution is a direct contrast to accepting the blue pill. And so as people start reading the Constitution, they start reading these petitions, they get educated. They realize what's at stake here. They realize how much they're losing. How many treaties has the federal government made that are unconstitutional? A lot. They don't have, well, so I'm not sure if, yeah, did I ever tell you about the amendment that Thomas Jefferson penned in 1803?
I don't think so.
Okay, so he penned an amendment in 1803 because the federal government didn't have the authority to grant land to the Indians, that they were to regulate them, but they couldn't regulate them within a sovereign state because once a state became a state, the state controlled all that land. And there was no enumeration within the Constitution for the state to regulate these territories in a state. They had to actually enumerate that. So he requested, and actually what he was trying to do was he was trying to create this large nation of Indians out of the Louisiana Purchase. He was identifying a real problem that could occur, and he said, well, let's give these people a place where they can, you know, that'll be their nation. Congress said, no, we're not going to do that. They didn't even consider his amendment. But the whole point is he recognized that they didn't have the authority to create these territories. So what should happen is every single one of these territories that these Indians were taken to need to be completely converted to their property within that state, just like your property that you live on in your state. And then, you know, I would tell the state to give them a moratorium of maybe 5 years from property tax, but let them know that they will be subject to property tax eventually. So that they have a choice. They can either sell and get the heck out of there, like in California. I would not want to be in California. I would sell all my property and go to a state that would be favorable, right? So now these Indian reservations in these blue states would be heavily taxed. These people have an opportunity to flee and take their property with them. Because what is property if you can't liquidate it into a currency? That's why digital currency is such a threat because it's no longer property.
I know we're running short on time.
Yeah, we are. I'm sorry.
Going back to Republic Review.
Uh-huh.
What is the real timeline for something like that, for that process?
I would estimate that once we get one state to initiate the committee. Because if you look at the process and if you actually go look at the bill and there's a flow chart with that, if you actually look at what that committee does, that committee starts actually communicating with every other state, basically like Kentucky resolutions and Virginia resolutions, teaching them what they need to know and what they need to do immediately. Once mm-hmm. we get one state, I think everything's in God's hands at that point, because I believe God can perform that miracle just like he did in the Germanic states in the 1500s.
So then we just need to get more people educated on this process.
But actually, just to give you some, you know, at least we have a breath of fresh air. We have these bills showing up. We just need to get that level, get over that hump of support in one of these states. The mm-hmm. first state that does this is the beginning of, and as you know, we just ran out of time. So my true apologies. We'll have to reconnect again, but we do have hope in these other states. Folks, I really appreciate Angeline coming in and asking these questions. We have to have her back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.